and most importantly, out of my hands. If I were to go somewhere comfortable like my bed or the office to check in on things or make a post, I'd be tempted to get sucked in longer and knock more things off of my to-do list. But the garage is ideal. There's nowhere to sit and it's not exactly cozy. It's the perfect place to sneak away to and get something done quickly without getting lost in it, and it's working brilliantly. I've also asked my kids to keep me accountable, which was an incredibly hard decision, but one I don't regret in the slightest. Our kids know now that their voices matter, that they matter. They know that their opinions mean something and carry enough weight to actually make changes, and that is huge. And it's been fun for me, too. They love keeping me in check, and I love the reminders, because they nudge me closer to the person and the mama I want to be. I know these changes are a little extreme, and they may not work in everyone's situation, but if you're serious about doing things differently, it's definitely worth the work of finding something that does. I was extremely ready to take my life back and be more in tune with those I love the most. So for us, it's been a welcome change. I can't even explain the joy I have found when I decided to put that beast down and look into eyes instead of screens. I'm listening more, stressed less, and I find myself even laughing again, which I'm sad to say I didn't even realize I was missing until I found it. I feel awake and alive and deeply connected to myself, my people, and my world again. And the new view is breathtaking. Chapter 25. Nooks and Notes. Any building is a temple, if you make it so. Phil Knight. For as long as I can remember, I've been a home person, an aesthetics person. I've always cared about design and details and decorating my walls in the most beautiful ways. I can still remember designing my childhood bedroom with pink walls, white kitten stencils, and the loveliest vintage shabby chic rose pattern bedding. It was pure 8-year-old bliss, and I adored every inch of it. As I made my way into my teenage years, I did everything I could to turn my 10x10 little room into an actual tiny house, before those were even a thing. My room was complete with a futon, a small round dining table that I used as a desk, and a full-size piano. How, I'm not quite sure, but we made it work, and I loved it. Something in me just longed for my own little space, my own little home, even back then. It was my personal temple, my sacred space. Growing up, I felt like the odd duck in so many ways. I was the teenage girl who'd rather peruse the aisles of Lowe's or Home Goods than the racks at Nordstrom or Forever 21. I wanted to stay home and repaint garage sale furniture or make my own pillows instead of going to the movies with my friends. I don't think anything has ever been more exciting for me, as long as I can remember, than cultivating a safe, secure, and over-the-top beautiful space. Now as an adult, I've carried this love affair into all 9 homes Isaac and I have shared together, from one-bedroom apartments and double-wide trailers, to the custom home we had built in our military housing overlooking the Gulf of Mexico. Each one of them has been a passion project of reinventing a space and taking it from something ordinary to something truly magical, even if it's just magical for me and my people. Having beautiful spaces filled with meaningful treasures deeply matters to me, and I've always wondered where this came from. After my grandpa passed away, I became even more obsessed with our Danish heritage. I've always been very interested in it and have found ways to incorporate my Scandinavian roots into our rhythms, but something changed after he died. And all I wanted to do was find out more about this wonderland he came from. I guess I thought that learning more about the culture and the way people did life there might give me more glimpses into how he became the incredible man he was. And maybe, just maybe, how I became who I am too. Turns out, this aesthetically inclined way of living is, in fact, very Danish. Which kind of blew my mind. In Helen Russell's book, The Year of Living Danishly, she spends a year researching the country to try to uncover their secrets of being the world's happiest country. During her time living there, she discovered that Denmark is very much a design society, and that plays quite a big part in happiness. In 2011, scientists at University College London studied this phenomenon and confirmed that looking at something beautiful really can make us happier by stimulating dopamine in our brains. Research shows that great art and design can even induce the same brain activity as being in love. Being intentional with the aesthetic of your environment is just the way of life for Danes. In an interview with the author, a Danish woman said, "We are simply used to having nice surroundings. It starts from the very beginning of life. Children come to school and interact with quality architecture and furniture, and so from an early age, they develop an understanding that functional yet beautiful design is essential to realizing the good life." And of course, the weather plays a part too. We're inside so much during the long winters that we invest more in our environment. You're spending so much time at home, it may as well be nice. There's a clear relationship between your aesthetic environment and how you feel. Amen, my Danish sister. As I read these words, I felt my insides leap out of my chest into a standing ovation, and I became even giddier that my antique hoarding, dish-obsessed, dinner party decorating self now had research to back up the benefits of such time investments. As our climate here in Oregon greatly mimics that of my Scandinavian homeland, a light bulb went off when I read these words, and I became even more committed to creating a beautiful, inviting, inspirational, and cozy home. You're spending so much time at home, it may as well be nice. My sentiments exactly. It's surprising that I am even dressed most days in something more than my husband's t-shirts, as spending money on clothing makes me want to roll my eyes and crawl into a hole. Unless your name is Lululemon, and your clothing doubles as sleepwear and workout attire or leggings I can transform into date night wear with a pretty sweater, you're dead to me. But pillows and throws and milk glass everything and succulents in handmade monochrome pots, take all my money. I may sound like a loon, and that's okay too, but I think there is something so intricately important about the environments we place ourselves in and invite others into. There's magic in the way a light-filled room can restore a soul, and a cozy chair with an intentionally chosen stack of books and magazines holds the power to ignite dreams, bring rest, and inspire creativity. A well-designed place gives our soul space to breathe and our minds a welcome rest. It becomes the backdrop for dinners and dance parties and a safe place to land when something wrecks our world and we don't know which way is up. If we desire it to be, our home can be more than just a landing pad for our weary bodies to find food and hang our clothes. Our homes can hold power to be absolutely transformative. They hold the power to hold us and tend to us, to shelter people and offer grace, to heal wounds and take the first step to mend that broken relationship. They can be a blank space to dream dreams and a refuge when you need to recharge. I don't believe we were created to be go, go, go people all the time. God isn't up in heaven right now preparing an obstacle course or a checklist for us when we see him face to face. He's up there right now preparing for us a home, a table, a seat. About a month ago, my last remaining grandparent passed away an hour or so after I held her hand, kissed her hot, fevered forehead, and prayed Jesus would take her home as my tears fell silently to the cold tile floor. It had been about 10 months since my grandpa, her husband of 67 years, had left us here on earth to see his home in heaven. And although my heart broke watching her go, there was a sweet peace knowing they were finally together again. 10 months apart really must have been agony after a lifetime together. In the weeks that followed her death, my mother and I cleaned out her and grandpa's apartment and sorted through things. It was a lot like the process of moving, but sadder. What gets thrown away, given away, donated? What do we keep? Two lives gone, the accumulation of their lives and their histories in a one-bedroom apartment. We went through boxes and drawers, sifting through staplers, extra stamps, and bookshelf after bookshelf of their favorite stories and photo albums. We paused to show each other what we had found and reminisce about some of the best souls each of us had ever known. My grandparents were huge history buffs, and I'm certain my grandma was the first person ever to sign up for an account on Ancestry.com, or maybe the first person over the age of 60, but we'll never know for sure. They loved keeping their heritage alive and placed immense importance on family heirlooms, history, and family trees. Dozens, if not hundreds of times, we'd pull something out of a nook or a box, turn it over, and find a tiny sticker with my grandmother's handwriting on the bottom. Crocheted tablecloth by Nora, Carl's aunt, in Denmark. Candelabra from Copenhagen. A friend gave this to Jorgen and Anna, my great-grandparents, in 1955. It is typical of candle holders in Danish churches and always had a prominent, visible place in their home. Pump organ, purchased off a traveling wagon in Franklin, Oregon in 1895. Pine chest, handmade by Jorgen in his kitchen. He made one for his wife and 7 of his children. Rolling pins from Anna and Zella. Before these moments, going through what she had left behind with my mother, before I couldn't hug her anymore or bake zucchini bread in her kitchen anymore, I hadn't understood why she held on to these things or wrote about them in such great detail. But I understand now. Grandma wanted to hold on to the memories as long as she could. She wanted the history of her loved ones to stay alive and their stories to be passed down. She wanted them to matter to the future generations as much as they mattered to her. And I get it now. Because I feel the same way about keeping her and Grandpa's memories alive. Growing up in a home that carried on many of these traditions, I've always thought that this was normal. Everyone has a house full of hand-me-down treasures from their great-great-great-grandparents, right? But apparently it's not something everyone does or has. And I'm increasingly thankful that it's something my family fought to keep alive. I'm thankful that my legacy isn't just in stories, but in stuff as well. Stuff that I could never find in the aisles of my beloved Target. For some reason, that seems clearer now after the last year. I've always collected home things from the people I love. And looking back, I'm even more thankful for it now as I've seen firsthand what it looks like to sort through what's left behind. I've found myself lately reflecting on what will it look like for my children one day. I don't want to have a house full of all the latest and greatest styles and mass-produced everything. If I'm going to choose what I fill my house with, which I get to do, I want to choose with purpose. I want to fill the space between our walls with books that mean something, decorations that hold stories, and vases that held my grandmother's flowers. There's a peace that comes with outfitting my house in this way. It's instantly home, no matter what actual house we're in. Because these same items have been making my family's houses into homes for generations. I love that my children get to play piano on the same keys my grandpa used to fill his house with music. That they get to read from his Bible, all worn from carrying in his pocket every day that he served during World War II. I love that our pitchers and creamers and some of our favorite coffee mugs were held by the hands of other generations before they ever touched mine. That the same hand-crocheted doilies adorned their Thanksgiving tables before we even existed. And now the great-great-grandchildren of those who stitched them together are carefully setting the table with them and rolling out pie crusts with the same wooden rolling pins they used in their kitchens. What an unbelievable gift I've been given that I didn't even know I wanted. I'm ever more tired of having stuff for stuff's sake, and all the more into holding things that hold stories. It takes work and intention and lots of creativity to incorporate some of these things into our style sometimes, but I'm committed to doing everything I can to keep making it work. And hopefully, if I play it right, my great-great-grandchildren will want to make it work too. I want to add that if you're listening to this and have a similar story, my heart leaps with thankfulness for you. But I also know that this is rare, and that having a history of housewares isn't something that everyone has. And I'm sorry about that. But here's the good news. We get to change our legacy. In the same way that we can change a family history of divorces or debt or anger to legacies of staying and being free and living full of joy, we have the power and the choice to change this legacy too. We can start telling stories. We can start writing notes and keeping things we find special. Isaac and I have placed notes in the glass we used for communion at our wedding. We've kept things from our children's baby years and every one of Isaac's fire helmets from his years of service. We keep our children's baby clothes to make quilts out of and gifts we've given each other over the years. I have a giant plastic tub that contains every card, note, post-it, and letter Isaac and I have written to each other over the past 18 years. And I have one for the kids' notes too. Even though it's not very nostalgic, we love getting our Instagram feeds printed into tiny 8x8 books that we keep on our dresser, and I'm constantly finding them laid out all over the bed as our kids laugh and reminisce over the memories. They aren't fancy, and they aren't as pretty as my grandma's handwritten leather journals, but they're ours, and I wouldn't trade them for the world. Because in all of these little things we hold on to, what makes them so magical is that it's us. It's our family, our heritage, our story, and it's one worth telling and retelling. No matter what we've been given by our family, we can choose to keep our family's story alive through heirlooms too. We can start today with that necklace you love or that scarf you knit or that photo you took. They all hold stories if we just choose to tell them. Chapter 26. Roots. What screws us up most in life is the picture in our head of what it's supposed to be. Anonymous. Most of my life, I've had this bitter angst about the mountains. I don't know what it is, but sometimes when hurt enters our stories, the backdrop can take the blame. What used to be simple geography can take on a life of its own, bringing back painful memories and almost taunting us with smells, visuals, and other triggers. The forests of the Pacific Northwest used to hold that pain for me. The trees, the wet ground, the soggy, earthy smell of it all. It was almost like they were speaking to me, taunting me. You can't do this. You will never, ever amount to anything. So why even try? For years, it was almost like this place would whisper to my thoughts, plaguing me with an echoing voice. You're worthless. Nothing. You'll never make it. And somehow the gray Oregon skies and dripping wet forest I grew up in seemed to reinforce those thought patterns. Sometimes I would wish I could fly somewhere else that looked more promising. Over the years, I'd found it was simpler to run away from pain instead of staying and having to stand and face the giants in my own home. During these years, as I processed the pain and wanted to run, I became consumed with all things Southern living. I dreamed of the rolling hills, large front porches, and kids with cute accents. I planned where we would go on vacation if we lived there, where we would probably go to church, and who we would do life with if we moved. Remember James and my propensity to go all in before I've walked through the proper check systems? Yeah, well, welcome to James 1,000 times over. I became obsessed with moving, and my drive to get where I wanted further deepened my frustration for where I actually was. It no longer mattered to me that Isaac loved the mountains and the snow and that our kids did too. It didn't make a difference to me that all of our family lived here, and moving would rip us out of everyday relationships with grandparents, cousins, and lifelong family friends. Selfish much? I know. It was bad. And I shudder when I think back on one of the worst versions of myself. I could no longer see the good things about staying in Oregon, and my joy was suffocating because of it. My eyes had become focused on myself alone, and all I could see was what I wanted. Somehow, the man I loved more than life became the wall that was standing between me and my dreams. What on earth? How does that even happen? But that's what deception does. Deception turns our eyes inward so all we can see is our point of view, even if it's not the truth. Sometimes we can get so focused on the things we think will make us happy and what we want for our life that our dreams actually become our gods. And our true God, and the plans that He has for our lives, drown in the wake of our own goals and plans. This is where I was, and it was dangerous territory. Sadly, as I watch the world around me, I get the sense that much of society is in the same place. I've watched wives walk away from husbands, mothers walk away from children, people step away from their calling, and even Christians turn their back on biblical truths, all in the name of, it doesn't feel right anymore, or, it's just not what I want for my life anymore, we want different things, this can't possibly work. Every time I hear a story like this, my heart breaks a little bit more. And the worst part, it was almost my story too. I almost let deception win and my own selfishness lead me down a very dangerous path. I almost lost everything. And I couldn't be more thankful that God, in His great grace, woke me up and snapped me out of it. I've learned so much in the past several years as God, in His gentlemanly ways, guided me through and, to my complete surprise, helped me love the mountains and the forests again too. But friend, something came out of this experience that shook me all the way through. We weren't put on this earth to make us feel good. We aren't called into marriage to make sure all of our own needs are met, or placed into a career or calling to fill ourselves up with all the happy thoughts and alluring accolades. We weren't even put here to make sure we feel completely fulfilled in the work we do every day or in the homes we run. And I know writing this is not making me the most popular girl in your eyes right now either. But I think this is a big thing that as a society we've gotten mixed up lately. We weren't put on this earth to fulfill our great dream. We were put on this earth to follow God's great plan. And oftentimes, sticking it out, staying put, and swapping our dream for His are the prerequisites to seeing His beautiful plan unfold. We need to allow our circumstances to refine us, to make us better people. We are called to be a reflection of Him, not a resemblance of society. We were placed where we are, in the families, in the marriages, the cities, the schools, the jobs, in the locations we find ourselves in, to stand out for His name. That's what this whole thing of life is about in a nutshell, mirroring His character, echoing His words, declaring His greatness, telling His story through our testimonies. When the world says that the loving thing to do in your marriage is to be okay with drifting apart or to walk away if you aren't happy anymore, it is lying. When the world says hold that grudge, make them change before you give in, it is lying. When the world says if it feels good, do it, everything you want is on the other side of fear, it's lying. These messages simply aren't true. At least if you are filtering things through the Word of God, they're not. I would love for my grandparents to still be here and for our cars to not break down and not to have lost our house and life savings when the economy crashed. I would love for those things not to be our reality. But fear has nothing to do with any of those things. Getting to the other side of fear won't bring my grandparents back or magically make our cars run or reverse the housing crash. So can we all please just stop saying that? I think a more appropriate quote for believers would be, everything you want is on the other side of faith. Faith means I will get to see my grandparents again on the other side. And I can trust that even though our house and our finances don't currently look like we planned they would, God has good in it. He is faithful, and he will complete a good work because that is what his word promises he will do. We need to stop taking things at the words of the world and start taking things at God's word. The Bible is full of stories of men and women who were called to do things that didn't feel good, but greatly reflected the love, faithfulness, and character of God. And that's how we need to be looking at our lives and our marriages and our friendships and even at our jobs at times. I'm sure it didn't feel good when Mary and Joseph traveled through the night, pregnant and alone, to give birth in a stable, or when Joseph's brother sold him into slavery, and when our perfect Jesus spread his arms wide in surrender to the lashings and mockers and nails. Following God doesn't always feel good, but it does feel right. I'll never forget the day my understanding of faith and feelings changed. During one of my times with the Lord, he whispered to my heart, "What if things never changed? What if your home situation and finances remain like this forever? Would you be okay?" After mulling it over, I realized that if I knew now that things were never, ever going to change, I would be living a whole lot differently. I wouldn't be as focused on moving or what was next or what life could be like if I got everything that I wanted. I would be living like today was the very best gift. And maybe I'd learn to laugh again, too. If I knew that this was it for me, I would be sewing into our city more and volunteering at our schools and getting to know the families of our kids' friends. I would work on healing instead of running. I would stop blaming the state and the trees and my husband for things that aren't their fault. And I'd open my eyes to the incredible beauty and freedom and adventure that staying holds. I would be cultivating everything that we currently have and trying to get it to grow instead of demanding a different seed or a different garden or a different life. I would simply live and be thankful for living. And I'd wake up every day and do the very best I could with what I have right here. We miss so much when we can't take our mind off of what could be. A light bulb went off in my mind that day, and conviction washed over me with a cleansing newness like the washing of Oregon's legendary rains. One of my actual favorite things about this place, as much as I pretend to hate my roots, I'm starting to think that they might just be the very best parts of me, because they keep me humble and true. This is where I found my fight and learned to dig my feet into the ground for things that burdened my heart. God found me in these parts. He met me in these trees. In the broken, crumbly bits of darkness where I tried to run, he found me. And he picked me up. And he's been putting me back together and bringing hope through my hurts ever since. I started to realize that it's not as much about my painful story as it is about his powerful sacrifice. Everything I've endured vanishes in the light of what he endured for me, what he endured for all of us. I know what it's like to feel the burn of betrayal and the emptiness of abandonment. Those are real things. In my life, and maybe in yours too. And I don't want to make light of them or tell you to tuck them away too soon or to get over them prematurely. There's definitely a place for them, and they need space and time and tending for you to become whole again. But I'm learning that reflecting Jesus is more about sharing the liberation of his life than continuing to circle around the hard pieces of mine. I need to keep my eyes focused on the freedom I'm living today, not the failures of my yesterdays. And maybe that's encouragement for you too. Now that I've found my way out of the woods, I need to stop turning around and bringing all of the crud of the past into the new seasons with me. At some point, I need to move out of my bondage in order to help others find their way out too. I can't help anyone find their way into freedom if I keep circling around and picking up my own chains. And isn't that the point? To use our story to help heal others, to move on, to embrace freedom, to keep living this full and beautiful life, whole and overflowing, with all of the good things so that we can lead people to him, teach them to keep walking, help them to keep fighting, encourage them to keep loving, just as he's done in our stories. Isn't that the whole point? As I began to open my eyes to the life God had blessed me with instead of focusing on the life I thought I wanted and didn't have, I began to see him everywhere. It's not about where I live or where I don't, and it's certainly not about placing the blame on trees and mountains when they obviously aren't responsible. It's not about my job or ministry or marriage or kids or hobbies. It's about what he has done in those things and getting the honor of reflecting his goodness to others through it. I see him in the sunrises over the hills surrounding my house and in the pink buds on the trees in the orchard out front. I see him in the farmers markets and in the family I'm surrounded with, and I'm filling up with a deep appreciation for where I've been placed. It just took letting go. Letting go of the map I had made for my life and embracing his. And as I've let him invade my heart in this area, I found that he's invaded my eyes too. He's enabled me to see all the goodness that was waiting right in front of me this whole time, just beckoning me to open up my eyes and find it. Chapter 27. Rhythms. Traditions are the guideposts driven deep in our subconscious minds. The most powerful ones are those we can't even describe, aren't even aware of. Ellen Goodman. We all count down the days like children, eager and excited for what's about to unfold, giddy with anticipation. We start planning months in advance and everyone knows what's coming. There is definitely a place for spontaneity and adventure. I'm a firm believer in them both. But what lights my heart on fire more than packing the kids' suitcases and surprising them with Disneyland the day after Christmas are the sacred rhythms that become as much a part of us as our very breath, our traditions. Isaac and I were the first kids on either side of our family to get married. We were the first ones to make any of our parents' grandparents. We were the line in the sand, the mold breakers from one generation to the next. As our siblings continued to go home for Christmas, expecting the same traditions they grew up with, we weren't exactly sure where we fit in as a newly married and very young couple. I remember early on when my mom came to me and said, "You two are your own family now. You need to hold that close, protect it. Decide now what is important to you and what you want to do with your children when you have them so everyone knows what to expect. If you start doing what everyone else wants you to now, they will always expect it. Choose your traditions now and guard them." Her words exploded through me like fireworks, and something inside me was ignited. I've always been a traditions and celebrations gal. Feasts and tablescapes and houses full of people make me come fully alive. But there was something so exhilarating about carving my own path and paving the way for my own family that lit me up inside on a whole new level. Her words freed me, and I knew I had been given a precious gift that I needed to cultivate well. From that day on, Isaac and I began mapping out all of the holidays and forming our ideas of how we wanted to celebrate them and what we wanted the culture of our family to look like. I knew from my own childhood that it wasn't necessarily the things that cost the most money that marked the pages of my mind. It was the little, seemingly insignificant things we intentionally did, year after year, celebration after celebration, that wove the fabric of our family memories. Over the last 16 years, our most beloved rhythms have come in the form of waking up to balloon-covered floors and favorite sugar cereal at the breakfast table every birthday morning. It's been Starbucks hot chocolate and snowman cookies before we drove around to look at Christmas lights, and Æbleskiver for breakfast, a Danish tradition I grew up with every Christmas morning. We find our way back to the same vacation spot in Central Oregon every summer and make trips to the family lake cabin built by my dad and grandfather a priority. We plant gardens and get apple cider donuts on our trips to the pumpkin patch, and Isaac and Ava go to the father-daughter dances. We wanted the little things in our lives to end up being the big things, and I think we've made good on that dream. When the kids were young and I started to dream about their childhoods, I remember looking at it in reverse. Instead of picturing them as toddlers and kindergartners, I imagined them as young married adults, college kids, and high schoolers. I remember asking myself what would be important to them when they looked back on their upbringing and intentionally worked backward from there. I remember specifically trying to think about traditions that would mean a lot to them when they were little, but that they would still want to take part in when they were 16 and 26 and 46. We decided early on that it would be fun to go on overnight girly dates and man adventures with the kids each year before school started. Being someone who's a bit high maintenance, married to someone who loves camping in the outdoors, this felt like a perfect fit. Ava and I get to go to a fancy hotel and order room service while we watch girly movies and do our nails. The boys, on the other hand, get their fill of campfires, mountain biking, burping, and getting dirty as they set out to the mountains for their time together each fall. It may seem silly or even extravagant to spend this much money for intentional time with our kids, but one of the things that has always stuck with me is this idea that we, their parents, are in charge of their childhood memories. We get the responsibility and the honor of crafting the foundation of their next 60 years after they leave our home. We are writing the book of their growing up years. And I want the story of their childhoods to be an anthem of simple, everyday savorings mixed in with grand gestures of extraordinary love. God modeled the same thing by sending Jesus to live on earth as a man, serving and loving his small community day in and day out, while also allowing room for water-to-wine miracles and raising people from the dead. Loving well isn't all mundane or all miracles. It's a beautiful dance that intertwines the two and creatively shows off various aspects of God's character as we walk it out. I think the most important thing about traditions is made up in the memories of them. Which ones are going to stick? Which ones can you do in any season, in any financial situation, in any location? What is going to say the most that you are loved, thought of, seen? When I look back on growing up, there is so much I gloss over or have forgotten about. But summers at the family lake and Able Skeevers on Christmas morning are among the first things that bring a smile to my face. As my children have grown older and can now look me straight in the eyes, it's become more and more real that our time with them is fleeting fast. I want their childhood to stick. I want them to look back on the time we all spent together as a family within the same walls and have it bring tears and smiles to their faces for the rest of their lives. I also want the time we have together to set an expectation for how they should be treated by others. If we love them well, give them the freedom to be fully themselves, accept them for who they are, and spoil them anyway, they'll grow up to expect the same love and honor from others, and eventually, that will be what they look for in a spouse. And hopefully, prayerfully, they won't settle for anything less. The world is after our children's hearts with a vengeance. All of its songs and movies and seducing storylines are showing our kids a twisted view of love and dating and acceptance. As their parents, it is our honor and duty to love our kids so well, so extravagantly, and so safely that they won't be tempted to bite on the counterfeit love the world offers. And I guess that's where my passion for tradition stems. It's the routines that my children remember that remind them of how special they are. It's the rhythms we share together that weave the tapestry of their childhood and may even help them pave the way for their own family rituals one day. I want to take every opportunity I can to shower them with love, attention, intentional conversations, and fun adventures, because the memories of their childhood are worth it. This is why we have fancy breakfast for dinner on Valentine's Day and help them grow their own gardens in the spring. It's why we sometimes play hooky from school to watch the newest movie on their list and why we never pass up a photo booth. When I stop to think about it, traditions are really the building blocks of our legacies. They make up what we are remembered for and what is talked about when we are no longer here. It all comes startlingly into focus when I look at it as the way our family will be remembered when I'm no longer here to cultivate it. What do I want it to look like? What do you? What experiences and memories do you want your children to share with their spouses or your grandkids someday? What do you hope your children will pick up and pass on to their families? For me, it's movie nights and candlelight dinners. It's funny photo booth pictures plastering our fridge and exploring the fields around our house in search of ladybugs and berries and frogs. It's balloons and birthday cereal, bonfires with Dad, dance parties in the living room, and Isaac and I holding each other close as we dance in the kitchen. I want to be remembered for being accepting of who each of my children uniquely are, and for being a springboard that helps launch each of them in their own way. I want to be a home of celebration and adoration and feeding all the people my people bring home. I want them to remember throwing kind words and forgiveness around as often as we do Nerf bullets, and have them look back and smile about our picnics in the living room and finding love notes around the house. I want them to laugh about our baking competitions and riding scooters around the kitchen island after dinner. I want their memories to overflow with play and possibility and a sense of deep peace, where they know they will always have a safe place to land, a family who will always listen, and there will always be Able Skeevers on Christmas morning. Afterward, have it all. Contentment is essentially a matter of accepting from God's hands what he sends because we know he is good, and therefore it is good. Linda Dillo. There are times in life where I stop long enough to soak it all in, where the hustle fades and the laughter rises, where I can sit on our patio and watch the horses graze and the sun fall. It's in those times where I can almost feel the tangibleness of God. He seems close and touchable and moving in everything. And at the risk of sounding completely granola, it's almost as if his creation itself is speaking to me. Those moments, though rarer than I would like, remind me what it's like to feel alive again, and they act as a marker in my heart that we actually survived the heartache that unfolded over the last 7 years. Sadly, these euphoric, God is so amazing and all of this pain is so worth it times aren't exactly my go-to response. I tend to be a bit of a hot mess most days, but I'm working on it. Truly, I am. Oftentimes, you can find me alternating between belting out my favorite praise songs and eating all of my feelings with a jar of Nutella. I'm learning, though, that we ought to do something great with whatever we've survived, to help someone else find their way out of the woods. There's an immeasurable purpose for why we are all here on earth at this appointed time. There's a reason you made it to the other side of whatever brokenness you've held, or are maybe still fighting to survive. There's a grit and an authority that comes with your experiences, an open door to speak where you otherwise couldn't, to join a club you never would have understood before, and to bring hope and understanding to someone who felt like they were the only ones before they met you. God has overwhelmingly good things in store for you and for those he will set free through your story. A deeply fulfilling life is inside each one of us, where we can live the kind of happy that fills us to the brim with passion and purpose, where making our greatest contribution in life and following our callings trumps merely waking up each day and planting 2 feet on the floor, which sometimes, I admit, is a victory in itself, but they are still two very different things. Don't get me wrong, it's awful when a situation doesn't work out the way you've planned, or when the very thing we love most is ripped away far too soon. It hurts when we have to adapt to plan B or D or even Z for that matter. But God himself, he's the hope. Not the dreams or the wishes or the way we thought our life would turn out. It's him. Him alone. We live in a culture that is searching endlessly for purpose and trying to be it all, do it all, and have it all. The funny thing about that is as believers, we already have it all. In him. Lord, you are my portion and my cup. You make my lot secure. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. I will praise the Lord who counsels me. Even at night, my heart instructs me. I keep my eyes always on the Lord. With him at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Therefore, my heart is glad and my tongue rejoices. My body also will rest secure. Because you will not abandon me to the realm of the dead, nor will you let your faithful one see decay. You make known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. Psalm 16:5-11. He's the gift that makes getting up each day worth it and brings purpose to every single thing we do. Things haven't panned out the way I thought they would, but amidst the tears and the grief of what I thought my life would be like, I've discovered something even more incredible, the life he has for me. It may not be the way I thought it would be, but when I stop to look around, it's so much sweeter than the daydreams I scribbled on my notebooks in school. Following Christ rarely looks the way we think it will. Maybe you've been fired from your dream job, or you've lost a loved one, or a person who said they'd always stay didn't. You're not alone. Just look at the lives of Noah or Elijah or David or Moses or Joseph. I don't think any one of them would have voluntarily signed up for the life they lived. Yet they loved God, and they kept walking through what came of them. They held on to God, and he was faithful. And we have the history that we do because of their faith. As believers, we almost always find ourselves in the middle of experiences, situations, and lessons that we wouldn't have planned for ourselves. None of us really gets the life we thought we would, but if we surrender, we can learn to love the life God gives. In a world where we are shown perfect homes, marriages, jobs, friendships, vacations, and families in spades, we can simultaneously feel inspired one minute and that our lives are completely inadequate the next. I think distraction and discontentment are two of Satan's most successful tools these days. If the enemy can get us to focus on all that we don't have, he will successfully deem us paralyzed to steward anything that we do have. Somewhere along the way, we've got to pick up this faith of ours and live like we actually mean it. We've got to act like the Christ we say we believe. We need to lean in, build bridges, reach out when we need to, stay when it hurts, prune what needs pruning, and stand firm in what God is asking us to dig into. We can't keep looking back at all that we've lost and expect to be able to move forward. We can't let the overwhelm of what we don't have oppress us into apathy. We need to look another way. We need to start keeping a scorecard of all of the good God has done, not just the grief we've walked through. We must make an intentional choice to remember all the answered prayers, right decisions, miraculous protections, and seemingly random blessings that God has poured out onto our lives. If that feels hard, start writing them down. Make a list. That's what helped me turn the corner in my own life. I promise the first ones to write out are the hardest, but I found that once I start recognizing the good and being thankful for the blessings, it turns my eyes to look for the good, and it becomes easier and easier to find the nuggets of gold in our rocky lives. It's amazing how different life looks when I lift up my head, when I put on new lenses and choose the hope that lives inside of me through him every day, when I count gifts and not mistakes, and soak in the complex simplicity of having a Savior in the first place. And now that I remember the hope I have access to, I'm calling on the Source to bring back the joy too. And I know he will, because I'm finally trusting in him, the God of hope. Today I sit thankful for the sun on my back, knowing it is a rich gift. Thankful for laughter, for a family that stays, for you, dear listener, that you've stuck with me this far, and for more blessings than I can possibly count. For hope. My heart is overflowing, and I'm even thankful for thankfulness and the gift of perspective it brings. I realize I had been hoping in the wrong things for far too long. I had been hoping in my circumstances changing, when really, the hope I needed all along has lived inside me since the day I invited him in. And that, right there, is where this unexplainable peace is coming from. I guess it is true what they say. We do find what we have eyes to see. And I found that having it all isn't all that mysterious, because we have the gift of Christ, who brought us life to the fullest. We just have to choose intentionally to grab hold, actually believe it, and keep walking and acting as though we do. Thank you for listening to this recording of An Intentional Life, written and read by Karen Stott. This audio recording was produced in 2018 by Christian Audio, which owns the copyright. No portion of this recording may be reproduced for any reason without prior written consent from Christian Audio. This edition is issued by contractual agreement with Harvest House Publishers, originally published in English as An Intentional Life, a life-giving invitation to uncover your passions and unlock your purpose. Copyright 2018 by Karen Stott, all rights reserved. Please visit christianaudio.com, facebook.com/christianaudio, or twitter.com/christianaudio to offer your impressions of this work and to explore additional titles.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.